ablation HRT. Can you do rhythmic dosing? I'm Dr. Valerie Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Robert Mackey from Progress Your Health. So this question that we're going to do about rhythmic dosing and post-ablation, uterine ablation, came in, I think, about 7-10 days ago. What was the episode that this one was posted on?
Let me see here. So the question, it was somebody that commented on our YouTube channel, and it said, so the video it commented on was why I refuse to let my doctor lower my estradiol levels. And this person wrote, I really like your educational content. Thank you. And can one do rhythmic dosing after having a uterine ablation?
Well, the short answer would be yes. Okay.
Yeah,
end of episode. Yes. Yeah. But it's interesting that they would. So maybe there's a thought out there. Now we're sort of speculating that if you don't have a period, then you wouldn't be a candidate for it, right? But on the last episode that we did, in some ways, not having a period. Now we'll get into the ablation details in a second. But not having a period on rhythmic dosing, in some ways, it is sort of like the best of both worlds because you get the benefit of the higher hormone levels, but you don't have to deal with the monthly period.
So maybe just to clear it up a little bit. So a uterine ablation is where they take down the lining of the uterine, you know, the endometrial lining so thin, almost as close to the basement membrane as they can, so that when you have a cycle, the thickening of that endometrial lining might not be able to get thick because there's not a lot of lining there, mm-hmm. as opposed to what you're saying is a hysterectomy. When you remove the uterus and you put them on rhythmic dosing, they're not going to get a period,
right?
Because there's no uterus.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are two different procedures and it's not, they're not the same thing by any means. And I didn't mean to make them sound the same, but we were talking about that before we started recording. So an ablation, technically they could regrow that endometrial lining, especially with rhythmic dosing. But what's the potential likelihood of that? I know we kind of talked about that before we started, before we went on live on camera.
No, it's kind of, I think it kind of depends on the individual.
Yeah.
So the reason a lot of women have a uterine ablation, and a lot of women will tell me it was the best thing I ever did,
right?
Is because they have such heavy periods, their mm-hmm. lining gets so thick, they're having such heavy periods and cramps that they're becoming anemic. And some women just have that history of the hyperproliferation of the endometrial lining. So when you have that ablation, they can take that lining down as close as, like I said, as they can to that basement membrane, but you can't get perfect. There's going to be some cells that are left around. So I do notice that some women, especially the ones that have the history of heavy, heavy periods, that lining might grow back a tiny bit because there's some cells there, mm-hmm. and those cells propagate and they can thicken up and have a cycle, but they never ever get the same, you know, heavy, awful periods that they've had once they've had an ablation, but they can still get a little bit of spotting that would be like a monthly period. Cause some women will get an ablation in their 30s and their ovaries are still working just fine. So they're still cycling. They don't need to be on HRT. They are, you know, their ovaries are doing their thing. It's just that lining isn't there to thicken up to have that monthly period.
So behind the scenes, the hormones are still rising and falling. They might have the PMS symptoms and a lot of those things, but there's just no monthly bleed.
Yeah, exactly. And their ovaries are still going to go through perimenopause and in between meno and peri and then to meno. It's just that lining isn't there to get so thick to cause those awful periods that they were having. And then some women, once they have an ablation, they never get a period again.
Yeah.
And so with the rhythmic dosing, it kind of depends on the person. If there's a little bit of lining left in that uterine, in that endometrial lining, then they could get maybe a small bleed on the rhythmic dosing. And then just to kind of back up for anybody that's new here is rhythmic dosing is where you're doing a hormone replacement therapy where you're mimicking the ovarian cycle, basically the 28-day ovarian cycle. You're taking estradiol levels and you're changing that throughout the month with day 12 being the peak. And then you start your progesterone on day 14 mm-hmm. to day 28 or when you get your period, if you have a uterus or you haven't had an ablation or whatnot. But that progesterone changes from day 14 till the end of your cycle. It's not the same dose every day.
Right.
So that's basically replicating and mimicking as close to nature as you can get. So that's the rhythmic dosing. So this question here is, okay, I had a uterine ablation, so I don't have any endometrial lining really left. Can I still do rhythmic dosing?
Yeah, and I think there might be a little bit of confusion there that just because you're not able to get a period, I can see where the question would come up because you're not going to get a period. Can you still do it? So let's say I don't even have any percentages. Some women within ablation, they go rhythmic dosing. Some are going to get a period, some are not. There's no way to predict who's going to get a period, right? It's just sort of something that has to be monitored. What would you do for if a woman, let's say she has an ablation fairly recent, or maybe it's been a few years, whatever the timing is, she's ready to do hormone replacement and 6 months goes by and she's got no period. Okay.
It's not super worrisome because we know they've had that uterine ablation.
Right, they're
not going to get uterine endometrial hyperplasia if they've had an ablation in the past. It's
sure.
just really unlikely, but at the same time, it's so easy, you know, once a year, just do a transvaginal ultrasound. You know, that's super easy. It's non-invasive, truly. Just do an ultrasound, look at the lining, look at the ovaries, mm-hmm. have a look inside. So I wouldn't say that it's really too much to be concerned about, but at the same time, just doing a transvaginal ultrasound just kind of
takes away any questions. Peace of mind for practitioner, for patient. Now, the other scenario would be you go on rhythmic dosing within 1 to 6 months. Now you do get a period back. I would imagine now most women that start rhythmic dosing, they get a period right away. Right? First 28 days or within that, 24 to 28, they're going to get a period right away. Some women, it might take them an extra month. Some women, it might take them 3. Usually by 3, now the clock's ticking. We want to, adjust so that it encourages them to have a period. With an ablation, you would assume, based on everything you've said so far, that it might take a little bit longer in general. If they are going to get a period, it might take a while for that to happen. But then Would they eventually get just a normal period a month after month?
I haven't seen that. I haven't mm-hmm. seen, honestly, the women that I've had that have had ablations, they really do love the rhythmic dosing because you're going at some really good physiological levels of estradiol.
Yeah. Right.
And the reason that they did have some of that hyperproliferation of the endometrial lining is because they were probably estrogen dominant as, younger female. So I do feel like they really like that rhythmic dosing, but I haven't seen them really get a period back starting rhythmic dosing. What I've noticed with some women is, let's say they had that ablation in their late 30s, their ovaries are still working. Mm-hmm. They might get, if they had really heavy periods to begin with, they might get a teeny tiny period every month just because there's a little bit, you can't get all that lining out.
Yeah.
And then there's some women that don't get a period ever again. Now, the women that had a little teeny tiny period after an ablation until they went into menopause and it's time to do hormones, they may still maintain that period on rhythmic dosing, but if we put them on static dosing, they should have no bleeding
at
all.
Right.
And then the women that had a ablation maybe in their, while their ovaries were still doing their thing and they never have a period again, when I put them on rhythmic dosing, later in life, I've never had them get a period back.
Right. Yeah, that's sort of that's why it's an interesting question, because it seems sort of obvious to you and I that it's, they're still a perfect candidate. So I'm wondering where that question comes from. Can I still do it?
I love these questions because, like in our community, our Progress Your Hormones community, we're talking to women, all over the world, and they're asking questions I never even thought of after being in practice for 20 years, like things that I didn't even think of. So I'm sure this is a valid question. It's just something that we probably overlook because we deal with hormones every day.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, and not understanding it from the patient perspective or the general public's perspective. That's why we do the podcast. That's why we have Ask the Doctor. That's why, this is interesting because these kinds of questions are really hard to find answers to. I mean, you can search the internet and scour the internet, which is why we did the podcast, which is why we're doing the community, because you can spend a lot of time looking and searching for an answer to that question and never find it. Okay. Unless you're asking a professional that deals with those kinds of things on a regular basis. But the question, in hindsight, it seems sort of so obvious that we wouldn't even think to talk about that unless someone asked that question in the first place. Okay. Because HRT for women with an ablation, HRT of any type is appropriate. Why would obviously that person must be somewhat interested in rhythmic dosing, but thinks that maybe they're not a candidate because they wouldn't get a period. Right. You don't have to. That's why I made that.
Yes. Because a lot of times on our, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay.
A lot of times on our podcast, we'll say, if you're on rhythmic dosing and you have a uterus, you must get a period for safety.
Damn it.
And I never thought about, you're right, with an uterine ablation. And I have lots of patients that have had ablations and they're on rhythmic dosing and static dosing, of course, too. And we don't want any, they don't have any bleeding, but that's because there's no endometrial lining to thicken up.
Yeah, well, that's the distinction I was making between the hysterectomy and the ablations, that if there's no period, they can still do it. Right. You know, so what you've explained about an ablation, very likely are they going to get a period again on rhythmic dosing? They're not going to get one with a hysterectomy. Right. In some ways, that makes it, like I said earlier, the best of both worlds, because they get the benefit of those physiologic levels of hormones without having to deal with the period side. So they don't.
Period is not that bad.
Well, I don't.
I've had bad periods in my history of my life since I was 12 at camp. That's okay. A whole nother story. Or 11 and a half at camp.
Well, how common is that? I mean, you go to summer camp and get your
period.
I don't
know, but it was awful. So if anybody else got their first period while they're at summer camp, horse camp, I think I was at horse camp, or was I at some, I think I might've been at church camp, but if anybody else has ever had that experience, please let me know, because it was not fun. So I will tell you, from a gal that's had not great periods, a lot of her years, is now that I'm on the rhythmic dosing, my periods are really easy, but I still have a little bit, I think, of a, I don't know if it's like a little PTSD, like I have to make sure I've got the extra super tampons, which I don't ever need to use, but I carry them around with me. Because I'm on this rhythmic dosing, I have a uterus, so of course I have a period usually every 26 days. But I only need like a little smaller regular tampon, because I'm Gen X, so I still use tampons. I know everybody else uses Diva cups or different things, but I still carry around like the extra plus tampons.
But you've never used one.
But I don't need them. But I still, it's like this thing, like it could leak through into the pants, like it did way back when, and for so many times.
So you're traumatized.
Sorry, I'm a baby.
Honestly, I empathize.
That's my only trauma. That's good.
I've talked to plenty of women over the years. This is a man talking to women about their hormones. So take whatever I say with a grain of salt. I don't know nothing. But we hear from the women that have had a lot of them. Very few have had smooth, clean periods. Most of the ones that we talk to, their menstrual histories have been horrendous. Maybe that's why they become patients, because they just had troubles there. Or maybe the percentages are more even than I think. I don't know. What are your thoughts? The ones that have had horrible menstrual histories versus ones that had smooth and easy menstrual histories. I would say, now that I think about it, I'd say that it's probably more like 60-40. 60-40 troubled cycles, 40% smooth and easy cycles. What would you say?
I'd say probably more like 50-50, because, that I always ask that, take that into consideration, because when you're doing HRT with someone and their uterine lining is really sensitive to estrogen, like mine was, you have to be careful about, what dosing or how you're going to start and work your way up and then kind of balance that out. But I'd say probably 50-50, because I do have a lot of women that I'll ask, well, even ones now they're more in like perimenopause and we're working on some adrenals and maybe some thyroid and some progesterone, how are your periods? They're great. And I'm like, no one feels sorry for you. No. So I would say 50-50.
Well, maybe that's why, because the ones that have had troubled menstrual histories are a little bit more emphatic or a bit more dramatic about it. Or the ones that are just like ho-hum, it's like, that's
fine. You calling me dramatic?
You're very dramatic, but you're so cute.
In a theater way?
Yeah. That's fine. I'm not complaining. I'm just saying.
I'm just teasing you.
Yeah. So you really think that it's that even? I don't think it's that even, 50-50. I think it seems like maybe, like I said, kind of adjusting for the dramatics. That's not a criticism. That's just an observation. I think it's more like 60-40, 70-30. As opposed to, I don't think it's 50-50. I think that'd be interesting. Like if we did a poll, if you're interested in commenting down below, if you're on the YouTube channel, I'm just sort of curious of, percentage wise, if you took 1,000 women or 10,000 women or 100,000 women, how many of them would say their menstrual histories were simple and easy? Oh. And how many of them would say they were horrible and they couldn't wait to go into menopause?
I thought you meant in our practice, like in, the patients I've met, I'd probably say it's
I'm basing it off of our patient population. That's the only information I have to go on. It just seems like there's more of the ones that are not fond of their menstrual histories, mm-hmm. and the ones that say it was simple and easy, you know, it's almost like it never even comes up.
But then now, you know, they'll put, I remember when I was young, they would, if you had bad periods, you just go on birth control pills. Right. And I don't know if that's the best thing now. And now they have IUDs, which honestly IUDs aren't bad. You know, mm-hmm. that can help thin that lining of that uterus
sure.
to help.
Yeah.
And then of course, like I said, ablations. I've had many women tell me it was the best thing they ever did
yeah,
in
yeah.
life.
Yeah, yeah.
Why didn't I do it sooner?
Yeah, especially mm-hmm. when they get to their like late 40s and all of a sudden they're bleeding like crazy. And, you know, I've just heard the same thing that relatively a simple procedure and it just sort of it gives them some relief from all the heavy bleeding they've had for so long.
So that makes me think about with this question. So I'm going to write back to this person and thank you for, you know, doing this comment about, you know, can one do rhythmic dosing after having a uterine ablation? Maybe the concern here is, well, I had a uterine ablation because my lining was so thick and
yes.
I was so estrogen dominant and I don't want anything like that to come back. Doing rhythmic dosing because you are doing these physiological levels of estradiol that can go quite high. Like I did mine.
So it could just recreate the problem all over.
Yeah. Are they worried yeah. instead of saying I need to have a period, are they worried because could this be too much estrogen yeah. for me, given my prior history?
So, you know, that's probably the issue. We talked about that on the last episode. Like on paper, you're not you shouldn't be a candidate with your endometriosis for rhythmic dosing. But what we've learned over the years is that you don't respond the same way to rhythmic dosing, even though the dosing is a much higher than static dosing or some of the other options. It's still not the same thing, or it doesn't become a problem like your own body creates in those certain situations, right? So you're probably 100% right. It's more of a apprehension to doing it because you're raising that estradiol level pretty high comparatively to other types of hormone. So there's a little bit of maybe they don't feel very good. So they're continuing rhythmic dosing, but they're a little bit apprehensive because it could recreate the issues.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will say, not to be worried about that. Now, if you start off, like I always think less is best. So whenever I'm doing the rhythmic dosing, I do start off a little bit lower and then get some of that personal history of their menstrual cycle when they first got their period.
So you start off very gentle.
Yeah. And then we work our way up and we test, because that is one thing that I wish that I had tested my hormones when I was in my mid 20s instead. My gynecologist gave me birth control pills, but that was the 90s, you know, that was the early 90s.
I think they still do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Well, I think the idea of an IUD is probably a better option than that, than mm-hmm. birth control pills. But
sure. Either
way, it would have been great to have tested those hormones to see where my levels are. Now, when you're a cycling female, each day is different. So that's why if somebody's cycling, I'll have them do their blood work on certain times of their cycle, or you can do a urine test, or there's saliva tests that can look at your hormones throughout the entire month. So that is one thing when you're on the rhythmic dosing, is we are testing the levels to see that they're coming up and they're coming down and that progesterone is up. I probably just needed progesterone when I was young, which once I did, we went to school and started practicing, I realized I need some progesterone. So
you realize real fast that estrogen dominance is often just progesterone insufficiency. When a woman's estrogen dominant, is she really producing that much more estrogen than a woman who's not estrogen dominant? Probably not. But the relationship between those two hormones is sort of off. Mm-hmm. So proportionally, you might have more because you have less of the other, and then the balance isn't there. So in some ways you sort of see the same thing when you do rhythmic dosing. You can sort of recreate some of those same problems. Too much estrogen, not enough progesterone. It's going to show up a certain way. So now do you lower one and raise the other, or you just raise the other? And it's interesting. So reading the question, you think of it from a practitioner perspective in one way, but I bet you're right. I bet you they're nervous. They're interested, but nervous to try it or start it because it could remanifest that's the problem that made them get the ablation in the first place. That would be interesting as to why they had the ablation.
Oh, I'm going to ask. I'll write. Yeah, we'll write a call. I'll ask them a comment. I'll write.
Yeah.
Hopefully they'll see it. But
I think either way, I think that when there's problems from endogenous female hormones, so the hormones your body produces, it doesn't seem like the rhythmic dosing, even though you're trying to achieve those same levels, it doesn't get to the same level, okay, ever. And plus, we, you know, you said before, I think on the last episode, that the hormones, it, especially within the rhythmic dosing, gives us a lot of control, right? So you can start lower, you can move your way up, you can you can adjust what the body really can do. You can't really manipulate a woman's estrogen levels unless you're just doing birth control pills or something to sort of turn them off. You have a lot more ways to manipulate with the rhythmic dosing, which I think is a huge advantage, right? A huge advantage, both for the practitioner to be able to manipulate it and for the patient to experience the benefit of it without their things going, you know, back to what created the ablation in the first place.
And, you know, for us, when we're, you know, we do a lot of HRT, when we're doing rhythmic dosing or static dosing or any kind of hormones, or maybe not even, we're not even working with hormones with a patient. There's so many other things that we can work with collectively in terms of lifestyle and supplementation and, you know, even just working on sleep habits and working on, you know, there's so many things that we would pull into that rather than here, take these hormones, I'll see you later. You know, there's other, ways to even downregulate certain metabolites. I got a question that we're going to write in our community from someone. She wanted to know, why is her testosterone turning into DHT so much? Where, you know, I have other patients, their testosterone doesn't turn into DHT and cause the testosterone, you know, androgen effect there. Everybody's different on which way their hormones are kind of going to manifest with them. So we take that into consideration.
I think I know who that probably came from. I haven't read the question yet. What do you think the answer is to testosterone converting to DHT?
Oh, what is that? The 5-alpha reductase enzyme. We need to downregulate that.
Well, I think it's how it's dosed.
Oh, yeah. So injections.
Injection versus transdermal. You're not going to see for a woman's dose a testosterone go to DHT transdermally, but you could easily see that with an injection.
Yeah, I do have some women that are really sensitive to their testosterone. Mm-hmm. That
I think all women are sensitive to testosterone.
Of, you know, that enzymatic conversion, but you're right. The if you're doing it as a replacement, testosterone hormone replacement, there's certain ways that can cause that to go really go into DHT. Yeah. And then you have to work on ways to try to block that enzyme. What is it? The 5-alpha reductase enzyme. And there's lots of ways to do that too. So that's where it, there's so much more than just here, take some estrogen and progesterone.
Honestly, that's why we have the community. That's why we're doing the podcast, because we know that it's complicated. And we know, I said this on the last episode too, that it's really challenging to find these answers. And women, you know, the 21st century, women deserve to have the answers. You know, there we shouldn't have to be searching so far and wide when there's so much variability and individualization to hormone replacement. And believe me, social media, it becomes a little bit of a minefield because everyone's got a different opinion. There's no standard of care. Honestly, with hormone replacement, I think there should be some safety standard of cares. Like, for example, the rule we've always had, you never give a woman unopposed estrogen. Right? You just don't, even if they've had a uterus or not, you just never give them estrogen by itself unless they're doing it vaginally or on their face, mm-hmm. Right?
Estriol.
Estriol. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's a standard of care sort of rule, a safety rule to protect a woman, you know, on a long-term basis. But other than that.
There's probably so many other things I could think of, but I'd have to think about that.
And maybe there's a lot of things there, you're right, we just sort of take for granted because we've just been doing them a certain way for a long time. But trying to create a protocol, maybe a flow chart, you know, if you experience this, then go this way. If you experience that, then go that way. You could do a flow chart, and maybe flow charts is sort of a way to create guidelines. But having one set of guidelines for all women, that's not gonna ever happen. I don't think that's even a worthwhile a venture to even try to do that. All right. So,
I liked this question. This was good. So, I know we said a lot. So, this is not meant for this is only educational.
Just for educational purposes. We're not giving any medical advice. This is just educational purposes.
But I am really curious because when I saw this comment, I really thought it was because we always said, if you have a uterus and you're on rhythmic dosing, you must have a period. But then
you're really demanding and adamant.
But it takes, I will say, when I switch somebody from static dosing and they've been on that for a number of years to rhythmic dosing, it can take up to like 3 to 5 months to get a period. I have had some issues with that. And maybe because I go low and slow and we work our way and you know, I make sure that, you know, nothing's going awry down south. But I thought that was what the question was about. But now I'm wondering, like you said, it might be because the issues that created the uterine ablation, this person is worried that it could happen again.
Well, so we were only 20 minutes in before we figured it out. Yeah. But who knows? Like I said, you'll follow up with them and they'll give us some more background.
Yeah,
but
I love all the comments. Yeah.
It's just interesting to be able to, to be able to interact on that level. Now, granted, you and I are Gen Xers, so we were before the internet, before social media. We're a little bit late to the party when it comes to social media, right? We started our YouTube channel a year ago. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it's been fantastic. The fact that anyone's watching at all, I think is just fabulous. And the fact that we have some knowledge that we can impart, and if someone finds it interesting or gain some value from it, I think that's just as fantastic. So if you have any questions, write them in the comment section down below. If you want to ask it in private or anonymous, you can go to our website, Ask the Doctor, progressionhealth.com. Up at the top, it says Ask the Doctor. Just put in your name and email, ask your question. And we do get a lot of them. We do sort of cherry pick the questions, right? Just the ones that are appropriate to what we've been talking about in the community, or things that have been on our mind, or things that we've been seeing with patients. But please send your questions. We try to get as many of them as we can. We really sincerely appreciate the communication and the conversation back and forth. Anything final to say about the ablation issue?
No, this was great. Thank you.
Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Valerie.
Take care. Bye-bye.